Morning, everyone. We're going to get started. A couple things. Again, if you've taken a clicker for, there's going to be an audience response thing where just make sure that your power is on, the yellow orange button on the top. If not, sometimes there's a sticker on the inside that you have to pull out to get the battery to work. And please return all those because they are our speakers clickers. And he will need to take them back.
It's my department.
His department. So he will not get rehired if he doesn't bring them all back. So please do that. Another thing, I just want to make an announcement. I don't see him here, but I want to congratulate Rupesh Madam, who, as many of the residents may know, presented a paper at the National ACP meeting this past weekend in New Orleans. He received a Young Achievers Award, and it is really a great honor to know that one of our residents presented a paper at a national meeting. So again, I'd like to give him a round of applause, even though he's not here. Of course, we wouldn't understand the paper. It was so complex, but it was really good. Anyways, today is our speaker is Dr. Vulcan Granite, who is a assistant professor, clinical educator in the Department of Neurology at the University of Miami. He got his Doctor of Medicine from Istanbul University in Turkey. He got his Master of Science in Neuroscience at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. He did his internal medicine internship at Montefiore. He did his neurology residency and chief residency at Montefiore and a fellowship in EMG and neuromuscular disease also at Montefiore, the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And today he's going to give us a talk on the intern's approach to neuropathy, which we all know is a very, very big problem. So it's my pleasure to welcome him.
Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me well? Okay, good. Excellent. So, although I was warned, do not let yourself be interrupted. If there are burning questions, do interrupt me, because I wasn't sure how simple or how complicated to make this talk. If it's too simple, warn me, and we can make it more interesting, or I could make it less interesting, so it's helpful. Okay, and if I notice that we're behind, I'll say, you know what, I have to move on. Okay, so I have no financial disclosures. I will mention some classic drugs that are used in peripheral neuropathies that are mostly not FDA labeled for that purpose. Okay. So, why talk about neuropathy first? You invited me for it, but thank you. But actually, it is a major problem. So if you look at the general population, about 1 in 40 people have neuropathy. And above the age of 55, that's about 8% of the population. If you take a diabetic at the diagnosis, type 2 diabetic, about 8% of those will have peripheral neuropathy. And depending on how you describe the neuropathy, be it electrodiagnostically or symptomatically, about 50% after 10 to 20 years will have neuropathy. About a quarter will have symptomatic neuropathy with neuropathic pain, which will come to you or to a neurologist eventually. And if to a 2010 CDC paper, one of the top 5 visits for a neurological consultation was neuropathy or numbness, burning. So it's a quite big of a problem, and probably it's going to get bigger as we become bigger and more diabetic. Okay, so let's give these a shot. So if there's a little sticker behind your clickers, it means like I haven't removed them to keep the batteries on and make sure the power is on. One more thing I forgot to add, and neuropathy is a huge problem in life quality and can be a predictor of death if advanced, such as autonomic neuropathies. Okay. So let's start with a case. So a 66-year-old gentleman with 14 months of cotton placed under his feet and between his toes, and he complains of some pins and needles, paresthesias, some numbness all in his feet. He does not think he's weak. He does not feel off balance. He does not have back pain. And he has a 3-year history of diabetes and metabolic syndrome. So what's the most likely diagnosis? So 1 second, and I'm sorry, 1 second, I did not start my answering system. All right, let's try now. Let's see if we have, can you see any? Oh. Where are my slides now? I can see my slides very well. They're in the presentation mode, but I don't know what happened.
Push the button again, see what happens.
Okay, we go to presentation mode here.
There you are.
Oh.
You're back.
Okay, let me start. Okay, let's try now if it works. All right, yeah, the responses are coming. Good. All right. I don't know how we're going to see my answers because I can only see my presentation and not your answers. 100% of you answered correctly, and somehow this will only show my slides. And not your answers. All right, let's move on. So that was correct. So this is diabetic neuropathy. And a quick other question, what's the spatial distribution? Is this a mononeuropathy multiplex? Radiculopathy, distal symmetric polyneuropathy, or sensory neuronopathy. Huh. I wish I could show your responses. So half of you said this is a distal symmetric polyneuropathy. Then the other half said this is a sensory neuronopathy. And one person said mononeuropathy. So then we have to really clarify what these are and how we came to this conclusion. Okay? So this is a distal symmetric polyneuropathy, and by far, this is what you see when somebody comes to you with their feet numb and burning and tingling and mostly symmetric. And if it's not, it probably is time to send somebody to a neurologist. So, but let's talk about these other patterns. But when we were talking about this obviously diabetic patient, what was our thought process? We subconsciously did, or we should be doing, basically first thing, okay, where is this problem? Is this everywhere? Is he numb, burning everywhere? Or is it only in his feet? Or is it in one hand? Is it in these two little pinky and ring finger? And then what kind of fibers are affected? Is this man weak? So are the motor fibers affected? Or is he burning? Are small fibers affected? So I guess it's important to review these because based on what we come to, we make our differential diagnosis. There are over 200 causes of neuropathy, and if we cannot come to this pattern, we'll never make a diagnosis and we'll just do blood work and testing. So the other important thing is temporal course. This man has had symptoms for 14 months. Sometimes it's going to be 5 days. Sometimes it's going to be 5 years. And our differential and treatment will really depend on that. And, of course, risk factors. So we decided this man has diabetic neuropathy because, he's diabetic and he has had 3 years of history. And we mostly see that's our exposure bias, I guess. And we said, well, it's diabetic neuropathy. And if we come to this pattern on every presentation, and then the other thing, maybe a neurologist will have to think, is this a demyelinating problem or an axonal problem? Because it really changes the differential and what you have to do for this patient. Okay, so this is really the gist, and I'll try to repeat this message over and over, creating a pattern when we see someone who is numb or weak or tingling. Okay, so talking about demyelinating and axonal, this is an oddball, curious kind of question. What do you think the typical nerve conduction speed is in a human body, in the typical nerves that we test? So unfortunately, I'm unable to show you the responses, but so far there is a random distribution in the room. So I see 200 meters per second, and let me see if I'm able to somehow show this, bring to the, if I maximize it, no. All right, so basically, most of you said actually 100 meters per second, and most others said 200, and two people responded correctly here, so that's about 50 meters per second. So that's our typical nerve conductions, and based on this, we come to diagnoses, really. Okay. Good. That was an unfair question, but I wondered. Good trivia. All right. So this is what we're going to encounter in clinic, and this is what you will mostly encounter. This is the pattern of distal symmetric polyneuropathy. So people don't have much motor symptoms. If they do, it's mild. They should not be weak. They should not be unable to move their arm or unable to get off the chair. In typical neuropathy, such as the diabetic neuropathy, motor symptoms will be late, if at all, and it's going to be slowly progressive over at least months and years, usually. Okay? So I was asking you what pattern this patient be. What do you think this is? This is a mononeuropathy. If the patient comes in and they just gave birth and they gained a lot of weight and they're hypothyroid and they have a growth hormone secreting tumor, what do you think this would be? Carpal tunnel syndrome. So this would be a mononeuropathy. It's a single nerve that has the pathology. It's not a diffuse systemic problem. Then there is mononeuropathy multiplex. This pattern is probably a red flag where urgent evaluation is needed. Let's say a 50-year-old man comes in, wakes up with severe pain in one hand, and on the right hand he has, let me see if this works. He has median nerve distribution pain. On the other hand, a week later, he gets ulnar nerve distribution pain and weakness. A week later, he gets a foot drop. So this is a mononeuritis multiplex. This is an emergency because the differential diagnosis is small. It can be treated. And if not treated, it can be catastrophic. So one of the most common causes of this is a vasculitis, be it systemic or just nerve vasculitis. So rheumatologic disorders, for instance, can present like this. And there's the neuronopathy I had mentioned in the first slide. So a neuronopathy is when your cell body dies, not your axons. Usually the problems start with the feet with the longest axons because they depend on axonal transport and clearing of waste products. If the cell bodies die, it's not going to be length dependent. It could start from the head. It could start from the back. For instance, So if you had all your sensory neurons affected, you would have like this pattern, complete sensory loss. Okay, if you had zoster and some of your cells died, well, you could have a pattern right here or on the face. So that's not a distal symmetric. So recognizing these rare patterns actually makes us say, okay, our most common is, you know, what we see. We feel confident that this is a typical neuropathy when we recognize these more important or scary or dangerous patterns. So, and it's important to recognize that not all numbness or weakness is because of a neuropathy. 40-year-old man was moving and lifting a closet, and all of a sudden they had right big toe numbness and inability to lift their ankle. So that man probably has a reticulopathy. And even EPIC, do you have EPIC here? No. Cerner. So when you mark on a patient's past medical history a reticulopathy, L5 reticulopathy, the system marks neuropathy. And it's not a neuropathy. It's a reticulopathy, completely different evaluation and treatment. Okay. And then there are the polyreticulopathies and plexopathies that basically would present with a whole arm being numb or weak. Not in just distal or proximal, but the whole thing. But I think they are rarer, and I think nobody misses them and sends them to a neurologist. So one more thing, it's important to recognize a stroke or a spinal cord problem that can present like one hand numbness, and it's not necessarily a carpal tunnel. It could be a stroke, depending on the pattern. So let me present another case and... So a 55-year-old woman with 2 years of dry mouth, dry eyes, joint pains, swollen parotid glands, and then 4 months of burning. Her feet are on fire. It goes up to the knees and a little bit of fingertips. She cannot tolerate the sheets at night. And she sleeps naked because even the clothes bother her skin. So... she has normal strength, normal muscle bulk, normal vibration and reflexes, and her gait is unremarkable. So she undergoes an EMG, and it's also normal. So what fibers are involved in this patient? Okay, good. A few more. I'll wait a few more seconds here. Okay, so most of you got it, actually. About half the room got it. The other half is evenly distributed. So this is a small fiber neuropathy. Small fibers are what make us feel pain and temperature. And they are not measured in electrodiagnostic studies. And it's important to recognize this because the differential is actually much shorter than your typical distal symmetric neuropathy. Again, when we made this conclusion, we thought, okay, what nerve fibers are affected here? So we thought about the spatial distribution. This was, again, a symmetric neuropathy, and small fibers were primarily involved based on a normal EMG and symptoms. So we already are much shorter differential diagnosis here. These slides are killing me. So then let's talk about what fiber types give us what kind of symptoms. So small fibers are our crude touch and pain and temperature. So if you have dysfunction of those, you feel burning allodynia, meaning a normal touch feels painful. Hyperesthesia, so a touch feels too sensitive, and numbness. Large, and then if you examine someone, they have decreased pin prick and abnormal temperature. If you take the large sensory fibers, which are, again, in diabetes, for instance, by the time we come to us, they are mostly affected. I must say diabetes is a combination of both, It gives us more pressure, more precise pressure, vibration, and joint position. So a person with a large fiber problem will have numbness, paresthesias, and poor balance. So they'll say, oh, I get up when I go to the bathroom, I have to turn the lights on. If not, I feel like I'm going to fall. And when we examine them, they have lost vibration, joint position, and reflexes are usually gone. If this is really advanced, their sensory large fibers do not work, and their joint position is so badly affected, they can get what's called a pseudoarthrosis. And let me try to show you a patient with. So this man has a condition that causes problems with the left arm sensory fibers. So ask to keep his arm straight with eyes open. So he has the visual cues. He's able to kind of maintain his hand. Now ask to close his eyes. The left hand compared to the right is much more mobile and it starts moving around. Now he's going to be asked to touch his nose with the eyes open, and he can do it, no problem with the right. With the eyes open, he kind of does it with his left hand because the visual cues tell him where his arm is. But if he didn't know, if he didn't look at his arm, he can still do it with the unaffected arm because we know where our joints are in the dark. But if your sensory fibers are gone, but then you don't know when they are, and you can't touch your nose. And so this man, if they had the same symptoms in the legs, they couldn't walk, no way, or take the food in their mouth. Okay. So continuing on that, motor fibers obviously will give us weakness and sometimes cramps and sometimes stiffness. And what we see on examination is atrophy, weakness, fasciculations, such as a patient with ALS or a significant root problem, radiculopathy. They'll have a foot drop and an atrophied leg. And finally, the autonomic fibers. It's important to recognize their abnormality because they can kill when they don't function. So orthostasis, orthostatic lightheadedness, bladder problems, constipation, erectile dysfunction. These can all happen in a diabetic patient if they're poorly controlled and their diabetes is advanced. And it's important to recognize that these are actually still small fibers. And sometimes a small fiber neuropathy will present with all these, such as a patient with Sjogren's disease, like the one I presented earlier. The lady with parotid gland swelling and dry mouth and joint pains was a Sjogren's. So, and what we see on exam is resting tachycardia. That's the first abnormality that we may recognize, then orthostatic hypotension, hair loss, and other autonomic changes in the skin. So, talking about, again, the fiber, small fibers, how would you diagnose a small fiber neuropathy? Let me ask everybody to make a guess. One person made a guess so far, 5, 6, 7. All right. So, excellent. So half the room said EMG and nerve conduction studies. The other half said nerve biopsy. So actually, the answer is skin biopsy. So nerve conduction studies will only evaluate the large nerves, okay? And a nerve biopsy typically will assess the sural nerve. So what we look at it actually is the small unmyelinated fibers that go to the skin, that gives us the burning and the prickling or the pin sensation. So this lets me advance my slide. This is a normal skin biopsy on the top. So what you see, these little dark lines are stained skin markers. So this is a 3-millimeter punch that we do in our office. A patient who's really burning. The patient below is a chronic diabetic patient with lots of burning. This is the epithelium area. So you have no skin fibers left. Small nerve fibers left. And on top, it's a normal scan. So there are norms per age and where you're testing them, and we can make a diagnosis much easier than and with much less morbidity than a nerve biopsy that can leave a patient persistently numb and sometimes in neuropathic pain where you actually remove the nerve. Good. So I'll stop with the small fiber neuropathies. The three that really we need to recognize is diabetes and alcoholism and sometimes amyloidosis, because it can be fatal and can be potentially treatable. The rest are less frequent. Let's move on. Let's talk about another case. This is a real case that came to me just 6 months ago or so. 60-year-old woman, obese. Poorly controlled diabetes, anxious, total body dolor kind of present woman, comes to the ED with 5 days of complaints. Those are: she feels dizzy, she feels she has palpitations, and she has had new onset back pain that started like a stab in her low back. And 3 days ago, she noticed tingling in her toes, and now in her hands, and both feet are completely numb. She has some ankle dorsiflexion weakness. She has no reflexes. And she looks off balance when she walks. So, what should we do for this patient? Should we refer to a neurologist with an urgent referral? Or does this require a non-urgent neurology referral? Should we just not refer her to a neurologist, but do our decency and do a neuropathy workup? Or patient is 60 years old, obese, 5 years of poorly controlled diabetes, does this require any further workup? Or should we admit the patient? So you all got this. Almost everybody got it. So this is Guillain-Barré syndrome. If we miss this, and this patient actually was discharged from the ER for diabetic neuropathy, and 12 hours later she was intubated for the next month because it can progress that fast. And what can kill is the respiratory failure and the autonomic dysfunction. So because their small fibers as well as large fibers are affected, their heart rate can go up from 60 to 120 and their blood pressure can go 180 to 70. So when they're on 180, they get some antihypertensives and they crash. So it's very important to recognize. So what we did here actually is to recognize the temporal course of symptoms. We didn't think, but this, we said, okay, this woman is acutely worsening. This cannot be your diabetic neuropathy that is slowly progressing. By the way, that back pain that sometimes throws people off, it's called coup de poignard, like a stab pain, can happen in Guillain-Barré syndrome. So we'll all see it. So it's important to recognize. So that was our logic here. Let's go with one more case. Again, we'll now talk about the temporal course, how we make our subconscious decision. 50-year-old priest, poor balance, mild distal leg weakness for 5 years, no symptoms. He does not think he has a neuropathy, no paresthesias. He has, he says, balance issues when standing for long periods, but no falls. He was able to climb stairs without holding the side rails. And brisk walking felt difficult. For the past few years, he could not run anymore. He had no weakness. Subjectively, he did not think he was weak at all. There is no known family history of a neuropathy. On exam, he has no reflexes. He has mild hand weakness that he didn't know, and mild ankle dorsiflexion weakness. He did not know. And he had impaired joint position. He did not know where his toes were. And he had a positive Romberg sign. Nerve conduction studies, so I had given you the clues, that his motor nerve conductions are 20 meters per second. So from the first questions, our typical is about 50. On exam, this is how his feet looked and how his hands looked. So there's some atrophy. Would you agree? Does everybody agree I'm serious? Okay. And the feet, he said actually his brother's feet are as ugly as his, and he didn't think much of it. I'm hoping this will... Oh, you can't see it. I change this to single screen for a second so that this works better. Are we able to change this to say, oh, our high-tech person is not here? If I showed a single screen, I don't need to see my next slide. I could show you your questions and the videos much easier. Hold on. You can't see it. I can't see it. Yeah, I mean, it's... I don't know why it's acting up, honestly, but... is Gary here? No. Okay, thank you. Yeah, it's, and I, you know, if I could do single screen so I see what everybody sees, I think it's going to be much easier. Sorry, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Stop it. And start it again.
Okay, and then can I see what everybody's seeing, like we were selecting it?
Right now, it's not seeing anything.
Oh, hold on. Second screen only. You know what? I don't need my screen. Oh, it worked? For a second, I...
There we go.
All right, where's my presentation? This is how he walked, if we can see him. Thank you so much. I didn't do anything. I just hit next slide, literally.
Try.
Oh, the computer went off. Sorry about this complication, everybody. Hold on, the computer went off. Hold on, let's escape. Maybe we can move down faster. I'm crossing my fingers. Oh, my God. Okay. Okay. Okay, this is our man. See if this works. I'm hoping I'll just be able to show you the slides and forget the questions. Okay, so what would you do about this gentleman we just talked about? So what we should be doing here is genetic testing. This man has clearly a genetic inherited neuropathy with very slow onset. He's not aware of his symptoms. There is an odd family history, but we're not sure. Most often people will not know that they even have an autosomal dominant neuropathy because the symptoms are so slowly developing. Okay. So as an internist, you probably have 10 minutes or 15 minutes with a patient. Right. So examining a patient with a neuropathic exam, what would you want to do? Ideally, you want to remove the shoes and socks and look at their toes and fingers, see if there's dysautonomic changes, if there's atrophy. And if you're just screening someone with, you're not sure, as neuropathy, what I highlighted is what you want to check. So functional weakness, what does that mean? So motor exam will take about 5-6 minutes normally. Functional exam, if I ask someone to walk on their toes and on their heels and then sit on a chair and get up without using their arms and lift their arms up, I actually did most of the exam. And if they can walk on their heels and toes, their ankle dorsiflexors and plantar flexors are overwhelmingly normal in strength. So really functional weakness is a very good predictor of what you would see. So if you wanted to do a 2-minute exam, that's very helpful. Sensory exam, the highest yield if you wanted to pick up neuropathy is the monofilament and tuning fork. Combined, they are about 90% sensitive and about above 90% specific. If you had time, you would want to do different modalities like joint position and pin prick. Joint position is gone late, but it tells you there is significant abnormality, and Romberg sign, which basically, inability to remain balanced is what tells us joint position is impaired to a certain extent. Reflexes are obvious if we have time to check them. And again, on the highlighted, if you have 2 minutes, gait will tell us a lot about a patient. So seeing them walk a few steps will tell us about their motor function, their mental status, their sensory status, and really of high yield. So these three things, see them walk on their heels, toes, make them get up and check their tuning fork if you can, and you probably will pick up most of the abnormalities. Okay, so one more case. 70-year-old woman with 20 years of diabetes and 1.5 years of intolerable paresthesias in her feet, distal legs. She feels like her feet are wrapped in ice. So, and then her hands feel like they're like sandpaper. She cannot go to the bathroom in the middle of the night without turning the lights on, and her legs feel stiff and sometimes cramp up, like they spasm together in a straight position. On examination, she has normal strength in her arms and legs, but she cannot feel any vibration and impaired joint position. Her gait is wide-based, and she has quite brisk reflexes, so quite generous reflexes. What should we do about this patient? So she has 20-year history of diabetes, and she has a lot of neuropathic symptoms. Should we do a diabetic neuropathy workup? Or should we just not do anything? Perform a low back problem, maybe this is a back problem, or should we look at her neck and do some B12 copper, or just a lumbar spine alone? So here the right thing to do would be actually to look at her neck and do the workup of a myelopathy. So the message I wanted to give here is, if somebody with 20-year history of diabetes comes to you with clearly neuropathic symptoms, and their reflexes are super brisk and they're spastic. So that's a pseudoneuropathy. I think that's when not to miss a neuropathy mimic. And this is the most common. That's why I wanted to mention it. So this patient has a myelopathy, and that's what they feel. So they have potentially, like, typical tube cake patients, an elderly is going to be spinal stenosis. And the other one will be a vegetarian who has not had any B12 for the past several years, and they don't know that they have a myelopathy. So the key message is, if someone comes in with clearly neuropathic symptoms and they're very brisk reflexes, something is not right. Okay, so let's go to our common neuropathic patient. What do we do about these people? So I had mentioned this typical history. So this is what you typically see in your clinic. So normal strength, they're not going to be weak. They're going to have some vibration loss in their toes, typically preserved at ankles. They may be partially lost. They'll say, okay, I have some dullness to pinprick, and ankle jerks will be gone first. So this is what you will see in your office until proven otherwise in most cases, okay? And people will walk normally. So what should we do if somebody like this works in our office? What's the typical workup here? So the typical workup that is recommended by AAN is actually very simple, very short. It's option B, screen them for diabetes, check them for monoclonal gammopathies, and check their B12. This is the highest yield workup. And most neurologists and most internists don't do it. So a study looked at 1,000 patients, 1,031 patients. And so about 18% or so had fasting glucose tested, about 16% had A1C tested, and less than 1% had glucose tolerance tested. So diabetes was kind of tested in half. B12 was tested in about 40% of these patients. And it's important because it's treatable. And it can really be reversible if not treated. And monoclonal gammopathies were tested in less than 1 in 5 patients. In contrast, 1 in 5 had an EMG, and 1 in 4 had an MRI. So this was a prospective evaluation of what is being done for neuropathic patients. So this is surprising, and we all can fix this as neurologists as well. So sometimes when we get a second opinion for neurology, neuromuscular consultation, they come with heavy metal screen and lead and arsenic and thallium poisoning. And I don't know if they ever yield results unless you have the risk factors that go with it. So this is a really nice study from a Dutch group where all patients are registered under a single system. So in a population of 1.2 million, a registry of 1.2 million, they looked at all neuropathy causes. So this probably supports why we should be checking what I just showed you. So 1 in 3 will have diabetic neuropathy. And then about 14-15% will have toxic polyneuropathy. That's the most common second. When I say toxic neuropathy, about half of those will be alcoholism. So when we see someone who has neuropathic symptoms, and they often don't volunteer this, how much do you drink? How many years? So 2 shots of vodka for the past 15 years, this is probably the diagnosis. It's an alcoholic neuropathy. The other half of that toxic neuropathy is drugs, medications, typically chemotherapy. What we use a lot, I guess, metronidazole in the hospital setting for C. diff, amiodarone. So some of these medications, and then chemotherapy is the obvious one that we would not miss. And then the other one is the immune-mediated, 1 in 10 patients. So when I say immune-mediated, these are the CIDP and Guillain-Barré, et cetera. But in this category, they also put the monoclonal gammopathy, which is by far the most common, and it's treatable. So I'm wondering, what would you test for monoclonal gammopathy? What would you send?
ESPEP.
ESPEP. So SFET misses about 70% of monoclonal proteins in patients with neuropathy. And if you had an IgM monoclonal gammopathy, it misses about 1 in 3, about 30%. So what's recommended, if somebody is coming for a neuropathy and you want to look for monoclonal gammopathies, actually serum protein immunofixation electrophoresis is much more sensitive. Some hospitals don't let people order except oncologists and neurologists, but some others do. But if this is part of a neuropathy workup, it's important that it's in immunofixation.
What's the difference between the two tests?
So serum protein electrophoresis, you know, you run a gel, you take the protein, you run a gel, and then you take a picture according to the weight, and basically it gives you, okay, how much of what weights you have. Okay, alpha band is here, beta band is, albumin is here. Remember that little band? Immunofixation is actually, they put antibodies and around the gel. It's more like a Western blot kind of manner. Again, it's been a while, but it's an immunofixation method. You put an antibody to the solution. So it's much more sensitive. Okay. The other thing is, 1 in 20 people, if we see 50 patients, we're going to miss two Charcot-Marie-Tooth or hereditary neuropathy patients. So the green one. And the systemic disease, where most common is going to be rheumatologic diseases, lupus, Sjogren's, and then amyloidosis, sarcoidosis. But systemic disease can cause neuropathy. So when we see a patient with neuropathy, it's important to know what their background, medical background is, and family history. Cryptogenic axonal polyneuropathy is the second largest group, actually. So 1 in 4. But one good news is this usually is slowly progressive. It won't kill the patient. So most of those, I had 5 years of numbness in my feet, and you know, I'm tingling and I'm bothered. They're going to be fine. They're not going to become paralyzed or die from their cryptogenic neuropathy. Interestingly, a recent paper says about half of these people have metabolic syndrome. You know, some glucose tolerance, that would, you know, glucose tolerance is, intolerance is big. Some people argue that it actually does not play a role, but increased abdominal girth and hyperlipidemia and hypertension, low HDL, actually is very common in these people. And so if we take all ages from that Dutch group, in younger years, actually, we should not be calling people with idiopathic neuropathy, probably we should come with the right diagnosis. So the frequency of neuropathy clearly increases with age, so also the cryptogenic neuropathy, which is the darker bars. And when you look at the lower graph here, so diabetes has a steady increase, unfortunately, from age 18 and on, you have diabetic neuropathy. Immune neuropathies, such as like Guillain-Barré, will be really high in percentage-wise in young kids, and then will decrease overall with years. And toxic neuropathy has this midlife. I guess people drink more there in their midlife. I don't know, but that's the pattern they found. Okay. So this is what I would suggest then, based on what American Academy of Neurology recommends, but and what's common sense, is screen for diabetes, check for serum immunofixation electrophoresis, and their B12. B12 is reported as normal when it's above 200. But unfortunately, sometimes there's functional B12 deficiency at, let's say, 250 or 300. So if it's less than 400, it's really important to check methylmalonic acid, which will be elevated. And again, it's treatable. And CBC and a metabolic panel will tell about the patient's, you know, current health status, and will tell us a lot. Thyroid function tests do not usually catch the diabetes, about 1%, but it's easy to treat and it's easy to test, so I added to this list. And then, of course, if you think they have a rheumatologic disorder, then we could do an ANA screen and, you know, Sjogren screen and et cetera, but that depends on their medical history. So this is, I think, an important slide, and we failed to do this workup usually. And when do you want to refer a patient to a neurologist? If the symptoms are acute and subacute, like that Guillain-Barré patient. So severe symptoms, they're becoming weak quickly or quickly progressing symptoms. Non-length dependent, it's not starting, it starts with an arm drop and then a wrist drop, and they have facial neuropathy a week later. So that's a red flag to send to a neurologist. Again, focal or multifocal symptoms rather than symptomatic, and severe dysautonomia. So these are really causes to send patients to a neurologist, and if they're becoming paralyzed in front of you, it's important to also send them to a neurologist. And we all use medications for symptomatic treatment for diabetic neuropathy or distal symmetric neuropathy. Now, I want to quickly talk about 2 minutes about what the options are and what they do for us. But it's important to treat the underlying disorder if we figured it out. If it's diabetes, controlling their diabetes. If it's B12 deficiency, giving them B12 replacement. Preventing falls really stops, improves morbidity, mortality, and we apparently fail to address this. The patient comes in walking like this, they go home, nobody sends them to rehab or a fall prevention program, they come with a hip fracture, then get a DVT, and you know but what happens eventually. Inquire about sleep, it's huge importance for life quality, so if they have a lot of neuropathic pain and they can't sleep, that causes depression, and sleep deprivation causes hypertension and stroke and etc. And foot ulcer prevention is actually usually well done, but it's important to recognize that people may not know they have it. So which of the following drug combinations, these are what we typically use, are you think are FDA approved? So if you thought D, you were right. So it's actually Lyrica or pregabalin and duloxetine or Cymbalta. So our typically used drugs, gabapentin and amitriptyline and nortriptyline, are not FDA approved for neuropathies. So gabapentin and amitriptyline will cost about $30 a month, apparently, and pregabalin and duloxetine will cost about $250. So first-line agents, let me quickly talk about the gabapentin and pregabalin. They're most commonly used. And then come the tricyclics and the serotonin noradrenaline reuptake inhibitors. So these are really the first-line drugs. And what we should do is to look at comorbidities and potential adverse effects when we choose these. It's important to start slow. But if they're failing, it's important to not to consider failure. If we kept them on gabapentin 100 milligrams three times a day and they didn't respond, so I think we may have undertreated them. I always start people slow because they get dizzy and they feel sick and they hate the drug and they'll never start on it unless it's an emergency. It's never an emergency for these, and go slowly. And avoid abrupt stopping because all of these drugs have withdrawal problems. The other thing I suggest to my patients, I ask them, how much are you bothered by these symptoms? Is your life quality affected? Do you want a ninth medication on top of your eighth medication? So when I ask the question that way, they often say no. When I discuss the side effects and etc., can you live with the discomfort? You know what? Yeah, as long as I know I'm not dying and I'm not going to become paralyzed from this thing, don't put me on it. Sometimes they say, no, I can't do without anything. But I think it's important not to, in a knee-jerk, start treating these people with symptomatic medications. They do not change the prognosis of the neuropathy. So this is a quick table, again, showing the suggested doses on gabapentin and pregabalin, so it's self-explanatory. And a final slide about what to do. So we have a patient with distal symmetric neuropathy. If we confirm this, yes, we treat them with one of these drugs according to side effects. If they're not working, combining at a lower dose may work. And sometimes tramadol or tapentadol as a second, you know, opioid derivatives as a second line is an option. If we're not sure these are distal symmetric neuropathies and could be a winning.
I didn't mean to interrupt your sentence. I understand how some of these can help with pain and burning. What about numbness? Any agents that can improve the numbness?
I don't know that they. I sometimes try it. So I separate these positive symptoms and negative symptoms, like all the negative symptoms, I don't know that it helps. I try it sometimes. I warn them it may or may not help. I got different responses from different people. I think it might be worth, depending on how numb they are, because people are usually bothered by the positive symptoms. They call it numbness, but if you ask them to describe it, is it like pins or needles or electricity? So they'll describe those positive aspects of it rather than absence of symptoms. So these are my take-home messages, really. We should have this algorithm on our head, even subconsciously. Is this patient, like, what's the distribution? What's the acuity of this problem? Is this my typical distal symmetric neuropathy? And this is going to be most of the cases. If not in this category, refer to a neurologist, because there may be a short, smaller differential, and it may need urgent workup. And highest yield workup is look for diabetes, vitamin D12, and monoclonal proteins. These are very good reviews I found online for geared for primary care doctors and internists. So if interested, I suggest, like, take a photo. You may like this review. It's very well written and very, I think, nicely simplified and high yield. And any questions?
Do you consider fibromyalgia a small fibroneuropathy?
So, I try not to accept the referrals for fibromyalgia, you know, often, because I end up with patients with a lot of joint pain. But, you know, some studies found when they did skin biopsy on patients with fibromyalgia, with quote-unquote fibromyalgia, about 50% of them had small fibroneuropathy. Now, we know some of these chronic pain patients also have a sodium channel mutation, sodium channel 1.8, that causes them to have chronic pain, but it's not in standard practice. It's in research basis. We don't do genetic testing for those. I think what I noticed with people come with a fibromyalgia diagnosis, but they have all these clearly neuropathic or myopathic or, you know, polyarticular problems, I think they're misdiagnosed many times, but still, so-called fibromyalgia patients often do have small fiber neuropathy. Okay, thank you so much for having me.